Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRue Show for Saturday, April 6, 2013. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. And our topic for today is to discuss the state-level mobilization for national leadership and international leadership, namely reinstitute Glass-Steagall now. It's do or die now. I'm so glad we have with us a couple of people by long distance today. We have from Maryland, from the LaRouche Political Action Committee, Danielle DeToy. Hi, Danielle.
Hi. And glad to be here.
She's in Baltimore, I believe, right?
Yes.
But has a national overview in addition to the picture in Annapolis and at large. And from the Midwest, we welcome back again from southern Minnesota, Andy Olson. Welcome.
Greetings from Minnesota.
Okay. And Andy has a firsthand report of all kinds of activation there, as Danielle. But so in a way, I'm going to just point out that we began this discussion, Andy and Danielle, last week when we had Tim Rush on, who has a national picture. He's based here in Virginia in the Mid-Atlantic states. West Virginia, too, and we had Dash Lee from Austin, Texas. And the reason we're, it's good to have you on anyway, but this in particular, we've had this break in Congress for the Easter Passover spring period. They're coming back this coming Monday, the 8th and 9th, and Monday and Tuesday, the House and the Senate are coming back. And this is no time for any politics as usual, of course, because everything is going to hell. And our guests, you all are going to be talking more about the response of people to this reality. And so what we're addressing here, and people who are listening now or after the live call on the archive, is we're really involved in mustering patriots to force the issue in Washington, D.C., force the shift in the United States, beginning with this a gateway change, which would be to reinstitute Glass-Steagall as it was in 1933, which would reinstitute the basis for sound banking and credit to create a future and stop cold the idea that government and people should, with their blood and lives, and you can mean that literally now in certain cases, back up unworthy, speculative, evil debts and obligations of all kinds that have been foisted on nations over the decades of so-called free markets. That was just a ruse. But in particular, that are now in the multi-trillions of dollars and that are bringing down that have brought down the entire monetary system. Now, let me just identify a couple things, and then Danielle's going to begin with an overview of our fight here in the United States. But I just point out what people already might have seen, even in the lousy headlines you get from CNN to your local newspaper. 72 hours ago came the latest instance of world insanity, where the Bank of Japan announced, with official government sanction, they announced that they're going to be committed to printing money at a rate never seen before. They want to double their monetary base of that nation in less than 24 months. They're going to have the Bank of Japan buy up all kinds of stuff in Japan, internationally, and this is in cahoots with the City of London and Wall Street. And so this is it'd be something like $140 billion worth in yen of a month. This is wild. This is beyond Ben Bernanke. His whole image is that we should just have the helicopter drop money. Well, that's what they're talking about. So this means money isn't worth anything. No, there's no system in which you can conduct any necessary economic activity. That's what all of this means. And another dramatic feature that we're in the terminal phase of the already unfair system we've had for several decades is, of course, the ongoing situation you've seen in Cyprus, where what was implemented was deposit robbery by the officialdom of the European Union, the government of Cyprus, where it's popularly known as a bail-in. In addition to bailouts, of taking taxpayers' money centrally or obligating them to back up worthless debt of select privileged banks. They also took deposits over a certain amount in Cyprus, and they have a memorandum of understanding foisted on, I think there's about 1 million Cypriots, I don't know, people resident there, where they're supposed to work longer, not have pensions, not have so much health care, not have this, not, in other words, austerity to the death. Now, we made a point in recent days, and I hope people have been following EIR online, the latest issue, or certainly following LaRouchePAC.com, the Political Action Committee, to see, in fact, this bail-in side of the, it goes hand-in-hand with bailouts of things, has been written into, was written into the 2010 Dodd-Frank bill, I think it's entitled 2, as it's called. It's been worked on in the European Union. It was worked on in the last few years by the Bank of England, working hand in hand with our own Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So they issued a 15-page memo on this in December of how, if there are systemically worldwide globalized, in fact, favorite pet entities like J.P. Morgan Chase or any other bank, Royal Bank of Scotland, these banks and this system has to be maintained over and above the interests of anyone else, including depositors, citizens, nations. I just summarized 15 pages in one sentence. But anyway, we could say more about the content of all of this, but our guests are going to be discussing reaching out to issue the call to patriots in official or non-official leadership capacities, that is, in state legislatures or mayors, county supervisors, and just citizens to activate that this has to be stopped. And I want to get into more. There are many other examples I could give about austerity. I don't want to do that. We can discuss that in the course of the hour. But what we're talking about here, I mentioned at the beginning, that Congress is coming back. So we don't have a scenario to offer anyone. We do want to exchange advice, information, battle plans. But what we're doing is, in everything we're doing, we're increasing the potential to make this shift. It can seem to the uninformed or the out to lunch that it came from nowhere, but not at all. There is an amazing process underway, fortunately, on behalf of mankind. And with that, Danielle, why don't you give us the overview?
Hi. Well, I would just say to begin with that anyone who thought that Mr. LaRouche was exaggerating when he said it's Glass-Steagall or die was absolutely wrong. And once again, he's been proven absolutely correct, because I agree with you, we really are at a moment where we have to provide a necessary, calm, direct leadership and guidance out of this absolutely horrific economic hell, or we are going to lose the nation and civilization as we know it. What we began to do in December, January of this year is to approach the state houses throughout the country, knowing that Congress was refusing to act in the manner they should. We decided we would create a pressure from the state level into Washington. And in the beginning, it was somewhat of a difficult process, but we've now reached the threshold, I'm very happy to say this week, of 13 state legislatures that have now introduced Glass-Steagall. And many of them, it is a bipartisan support for Glass-Steagall, which I think is also absolutely crucial. I was looking it over last night and reviewing all of the work we've done around the country, because we'd like to actually have it introduced in about 20 states. We think that would be a critical threshold. But if you look outside of the 13 states where it's now been introduced, we have intense activity in another 21 states around the country. And that is supporters who listen to this call, who get on LaRouche PAC, are engaging with us on the state level to both educate the state elected officials on the reality of what's going on and to actually provide the solution. And So what you're seeing right now is a situation where of a several-month process, you have a growing number of state-elected officials that we've been talking to and working with who are beginning to understand what exactly is going on. I'm not saying they understand completely that we're faced with an existential crisis of civilization, but they definitely realize they are faced with an impossible situation where, on one hand, they're confronted with this endpoint, years of physical economic collapse. And in many states, it's very evident on the question of infrastructure collapse. Roads, bridges, water infrastructure, schools and hospitals. These areas are being hit very, very hard because of years of lack of investment. And now it's showing, it's rearing its ugly head in terms of the impact. But you also have a cumulative effect of widespread extended job loss, especially in the more productive economic sector. And I'm sure we're going to hear more of the question of the crisis in agriculture, but also in heavy industry. Here in Maryland, Sparrows Point, which was the number one steel producer in the world 50 years ago,
Bethlehem
is now gone.
Steel, right. People should
yes.
show it was Bethlehem
Steel. Bethlehem Steel, yes, it's now gone. And you also see a situation where one-third of American counties are simply disappearing. They no longer exist. On top of all that, you have coming from the federal level with the federal budget cuts and Obama's psychotic policy of hyperinflation, the cuts in Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, all of this is directly impacting the state economic budgets. It is this that we're intervening into with Glass-Steagall. Now, when we first went to many of these state legislatures 2 years ago on Glass-Steagall, they were very aloof about it, saying, we had Dodd-Frank, they're taking care of it, the bailout, let's wait for TARP to work, whatever the line was. Now we're coming back to them, and they're saying, oh, yes, you were here 2 years ago on Glass-Steagall, or you were here 4 years ago on HBPA, Homeowner and Bank Protection Act. And they remember our warnings then. Now, if you look at the time frame in which we were entering these legislatures in January and February, warning about the pending crisis, and then coming back to these legislatures just over the last few weeks with Cyprus and now the Japan hyperinflation, they are really beginning to listen. So I think we really have to escalate, around the country in terms of the work that we're doing and just really demand that all of our supporters, friends, and localities just pour it on a great deal over the coming weeks, because I think we're going to be able to create what we need in Washington from the work that we're doing on the state level.
Right, and maybe you want to continue just a bit, Danielle, with some of the
sure.
latest for people. It just makes it easier. That is, Mississippi was one of the states, but go ahead about Maine.
Mississippi was a nice little surprise. Over the last few weeks, what we've done is we've been able to open up in a very, very big way California. One of the strategies we've come up with recently is to organize what we call a day of action in various state capitals.
Okay.
So, for instance, in California, for about a week or so, we built up meetings to meet with state delegates, state elected officials, and we were actually able to organize and did 75 meetings in one day with various offices in one capital,
wow.
which is, yeah, it's phenomenal. And again, it's the people are being very, very receptive because of the work that we've done. We've done something similar. We're planning something similar in Texas, in New York, Florida, North Carolina. This has had a very big impact. On Minnesota, we've done some excellent work. We've right now created kind of this phenomenon nationally where we can begin to call into a state legislature and get an immediate feedback because of all the work that we've done around the country. For instance, we just started calling into both Colorado and Alaska, and it appears to be almost overnight, we're getting very serious feedback on what can I do as a state elected official to have an impact to actually do this in Washington.
Do you want to pick up on that, Andy? You've been in St. Paul this week.
Yes. This is the upper Midwest, and I should point out that South Dakota was really the linchpin or the leader of this movement in the legislature where last month in South Dakota, the state legislature endorsed a resolution that would be sent to Washington that would be distributed to their congressmen, the senators, and the president of the United States that we need to return to the banking standard of Glass-Steagall. They passed that, and I was pretty awed that this happened in a neighboring state.
Mm-hmm.
Although we have some really articulate, good people in South Dakota that are very determined. So we went about 3 weeks ago, maybe a little bit longer, to Minnesota, and it was fairly easy to get into these offices, especially if you're going in on behalf of one of their constituents. And you know, there was good conversation, and with one particular, there were four of us in this representative's office, and not everyone can focus to four people firing at you, but he was able to kind of get it, and I was impressed with the questions and so forth, and he said, well, let me think about this, and I'll check out how the wind is blowing and so forth. And then we didn't hear anything, and you know, we had prospects, but I went to a town meeting a couple weeks ago when he was back here, and then we went back beginning of this week on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. And we had Tim Luke from South Dakota, who was one of the driving forces in South Dakota, to come along with us. And the first office we went into, that I said, let's go into Representative Hamilton's office here. So the secretary, I had called, but I didn't have a specific time because I didn't know when we were going to be there. And she said, well, he's busy. And so we waited, and pretty soon the door opened up, and he was in his office, and she said, well, I think you can maybe go in there. So we waited a few minutes, and when we got in there, there were three of us, another Minnesotan, Tim Luke, and myself. And he had questions, and he had done some research. He had been actually trying to figure out about Glass-Steagall. And when we got in there, he wanted to ask these devil's advocate questions that you get out of all these Wikipedia and so forth. And Tim was very effective in countering his objections. And then he had his iPad along and played the clip of my representative, U.S. Representative Colin Peterson, who's a 22-year congressman from the western side of Minnesota. It's all agriculture. And he played this clip where Colin said, two of the worst votes I ever made in this place was this 2000 Commodity Futures Modernization Act, where we deregulated the swaps and the margins that you know, the sky was the limit, essentially. 90% of them deregulated. And he said, we gave them legal certainty. There were $80 billion in swaps before, at that time, and it went to $700 trillion, and it blew up on us. So he said this right on the Huffington Post, where it was pretty kind of a moment when a congressman was being candid. Most of these congressmen are not that candid.
Yeah, actually, he was speaking to the full committee of the House of Representatives Agriculture Committee, in which, of course, he's the minority ranking member. But it was carried, as you say.
And to situate how some of these congressmen are, the Congressman Noem from South Dakota was sitting directly across from him. He was speaking to her and everyone else on the committee, and he said, so we're going to deregulate. You vote how you want the remaining 10% of these derivatives. And he said, just be careful. You may not want to, but if you vote in favor of this, this could come back to haunt you. And Congressman Noem, she voted for more deregulation, and she represents a rural area, but her chief contributor publicly on the records for campaign contributions is a gentleman that's in charge of Premier Bank in South Dakota, was one of the biggest credit card regional credit card companies, and is worth a tremendous amount of money, and he's bought up the regional hospital that's in Sioux Falls and Fargo, and Poet, who is the ethanol, they distill all this ethanol, and you know they have a lot riding on the green agenda, and that was another contributor. So she's voting for the big interest, and her constituents, they're not. So that's what we're faced with. But back to Minnesota, as we stood there, the congressman, after Tim had done that, he stood up and he said, I'm sick of this. And he said to his secretary, take this South Dakota, the passed resolution, take this down to drafting and have it drafted. And we stood there, and the next day we came back, and the draft had come back, and it is now an active resolution with open for endorsements, and we have to do work on the Senate side. I've been, you know, the iron is hot now. Like, I can't hardly emphasize enough how these representatives and senators are under a lot of pressure, and they're very animated. And sometimes the women are the most animated, the congresswomen, as anybody. I mean, this lady, we walked in her office, and she said, are you guys representing the banks? And we said, oh, no, we're citizen lobbyists, but we want to put a stop to this too big to fail and re-implement Glass-Steagall. And then she calmed down a little bit, but she could have been on my seat. But now the point is to get people like this to endorse this and understand. I mean, we have a big job to educate these people, and we can give them literature and facts and so forth, but they've got to do some homework too. If they want to really do their job up there, Glass-Steagall is the only way. Mr. LaRouche has said this, and it's crystal clear. The only way that we're going to get out of this financial breakdown and this crisis in our country is Glass-Steagall. Return to Glass-Steagall, and that's the message that people on this call have to really take personally. That there's nothing else. The only way is to, by the force of law, do what FDR did it back in 1933. So it's, if you, as a person on this call, are a little bit nervous about going to your state legislature, don't feel that way. And if you're going to find some really open legislators there in Minnesota, Tuesday they were talking about cutting $150 million out of the budget for handicapped people, and they had a huge rally there, and people were yelling and screaming, and they had posters, and Tim talked to one of the ladies that was sort of in charge of it, and he just hammered it home that this is because we don't have Glass-Steagall that you're here. There's not going to be money for you. Glass-Steagall is the only way that we can stop this crisis.
Absolutely.
So I'll stop there, and maybe other states, or Danielle, you go ahead.
Yeah. No, Andy, I appreciate what you've said, because I think there still is, unfortunately, a bit of hesitancy by people to actually confront their state representative. But they are the teachers, the union activists, the farmers, the doctors. You definitely have too many lawyers, if types, if you will, in the state legislatures around the country. But many of these people are, it's a part-time job, and they do it out of a public service. The Maryland legislature leaves on Monday. It's the end of their session. They introduced the bill. We had an excellent hearing. Somebody from the Bankers Association came and testified, but she had very little impact, frankly, because they're underestimating what we're doing on this mobilization around Glass-Steagall in the state legislature. But when we went around yesterday and we were talking to some of the offices, we were very struck at how closely they are following the developments in Cyprus. And when we went into one office who we've worked very, very closely with in this particular legislative session, she was completely blown away. She said, I am really worried. They're just moving in and just stealing people's money. She said, how are we going to stop this from happening here? And we said it's got to be Glass-Steagall. But she was very, very blown away that this had unraveled so rapidly. And she made a commitment that she's going to work with us once her session is over to continue to put the pressure on Congress. So she's come much closer, and there's been a much greater understanding on her part. I agree with you. They have to do a lot of the hard intellectual work, but they're very open to it right now. They're very open to hearing what we have to say. I'll just tell you one remarkable story. We went into one of the offices in the Maryland State House, and it was one of the legislative aides was there. She's originally from Great Britain, and we were talking to her, and she says, oh, I've been following this very closely. I have friends in Cyprus. So one of the people on our delegation said, oh, my God, how are they getting by in Cyprus? And she says, well, they're probably eating dog food and drinking lots of gin. So, you know, and we were kind of blown away, but that's the response. But I'm just pointing this out because I think when we go to these legislatures around the country, we have to be very aware. Look, Congress, unfortunately, they're out of touch to a certain extent. Sometimes it's because, as we know, they've been bought off by Wall Street, and we know it. We have the figures. We know how much they got. In other senses, they've just been in the halls of Congress too long. I was actually talking to one of the legislative aides of a chairman of a Democratic leader of a major committee, and the legislative aide in Washington. We said to him, "Look, you don't understand reality. People are suffering." And he snapped right back at us, and he said, no, you don't understand reality. Reality is right here in the halls of Congress.
Oh, no.
And of course, the whole delegation, we all kind of looked at each other and shrugged our shoulders and said, this guy does not understand the real world. So it is a real problem when you're dealing with Congress. But when you're dealing with these state houses, look, they are confronted with the fact of the ramifications of what they're doing with these state budgets. And it's getting worse and worse and worse for them. Look, New York is struggling right now because the banks that got the FEMA money are not releasing the money to the people who are hit by Sandy. And, you know, the state was able to hash out a budget, but nobody's particularly happy with it. And the ramifications of what's going to come out once the cuts and lack of funding is beginning to feel itself are going to be massive. You know, here in the state of Maryland, it's now coming out, now that people are reading the fine print of the budget, massive cuts to the mental health in the state of Maryland. In other states like North Carolina and Florida, where you have widespread unemployment, they've cut unemployment insurance from 26 weeks to 20 weeks, now as few as 12 weeks. The governors all know, any number of them that you talk to, that they have to create jobs. But the only thing that they can think of under the present matrix of what they're dealing with is trying to create jobs in things like gambling casinos, tourism, because there's no industry and there's no commitment to build infrastructure. We are attracting a lot of the state officials who realize that you're going to have to get some kind of investment in infrastructure. Massive, and that this is a way to create job production, to create jobs, and to actually build their way out. Then they're confronted with, well, how are you going to pay for that? And that's where this whole question of Glass-Steagall plus comes in. But I agree with you. People should not hesitate at all in confronting their state elected official right now, and that they have to do so with the authority of LaRouche and LaRouche's ideas and these principles with them when they confront their state elected official.
Right. Just to fill out the pattern you're saying, Sam, I mean, just because if you take what you said about California, that amazing having 75 meetings in one day, you know, you're describing a whole potential field for rapid shift. And the organizers involved, somebody said they ran into a lot of just like Minnesota had the people rallying to prevent cuts to the disabled. The private hospitals that serve the poor in California are facing going out of business within months under the current budget and economic conditions in the state of California. So they have a group called PEACH, P-E-A-C-H, which stands something for something like private hospitals that serve low-income people. So they were all over the place. And I'm sure, Danielle, you're in Washington a lot on the Hill.
Yeah.
Among the people appealing for action were the civil engineers,
Society for Civil Engineering.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So they were all there, again, pointing out the obvious. They keep a quantified list of how many bridges, how many deficient levees, right? So there again, we're back to the fact that people know it. Are they heart dead as well as brain dead because they've been bought off, as Andy was describing, a representative from South Dakota, or the others on that agriculture committee where Colin Peterson warned them? But I think one of the Connecticut Democrats, I forget his name, I think it might be Hines.
Hines is right.
Yeah. He was one of the originators. There's a guy in Georgia that they're getting hand over fist money directly from the transatlantic City of London Wall Street insurance types. So they're gone. But there are dozens and dozens of others, state or federal, that for whom now is the reality shock, and they're potentially capable of responding, is what you're saying. Just staying for a moment on the economic conditions, Danielle, you were summarizing the situation in Hawaii. You know, that's a place where you still have images of nice beaches and pineapples, but the thing is,
sure,
economic crisis, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I actually didn't even realize this until I called into the Hawaiian State House and started talking to certain elected officials. Some of the statistics that I'd like to put out, I can't even find. For instance, well, what you see is what happened was in 2010, and there was a lengthy study done by the state of Hawaii. It was commissioned to actually study the infrastructure of Hawaii. And it was shocking. I mean, it actually was worse grades than what Army Corps of Engineers, or the American Society of Civil Engineers puts out. They always put out these Ds, you know, on American infrastructure. And this was even worse. And they admit that the bridges are non-functional. The sewage system, this part I didn't really think about, but you're dealing with an area in which, you know, there's not been a lot of investment through the years, and it's all on marshy land. So they really have to come up with a new technology on how to deal with the sewage system, and they haven't done it. So you now have a situation where it has begun to break along the seams. So when they have these heavy rains, it just all washes up onto the streets. And this is what they're dealing with. But the thing that really got one of the legislators that I talked to, which I can't even really... The statistics on homelessness are actually very difficult to come up with. I was actually talking to somebody here in the D.C. area about it, because HUD does these studies on homelessness, but they generally do them in the dead of the winter. They start in January and try to do a count, and it's very difficult to really get an honest assessment of homelessness. But in Hawaii, what you had was a big influx from the mainland when the housing bubble blew out, but also you had a collapse of the housing bubble throughout Hawaii. So the homelessness, not simply among young or working age, But now they're beginning to really see an escalation of homelessness among the elderly. And this is what really has created a real shock among certain people in the legislature, because they have no idea of how to deal with this, because people can actually live on the beaches and in the area because of the climate, but it's getting out of control.
Mm-hmm.
So you combine that with the actual collapse in infrastructure, where the schools are decrepit, the roads have not been modernized, although the increase in traffic has. So you have these massive traffic jams that, as a former New Yorker, you always think of trying to get in and out of Manhattan, and the idea that you would have that on a major island on Hawaii just doesn't quite strike your mind. But it is true. When you think of Hawaii, you think of tourism, you think of beaches and palm trees, and you're looking at a real economic collapse, that which is sending off alarm bells. They do not have the funding. It's not possible. They're now in a state of panic about the sequestration, because one of the main economic sectors in Hawaii, as we all know, is Pearl Harbor, you know, the military bases, and the civilian sector that works there is going to get hit, and it's going to get hit hard. The Defense Department is coming out openly saying shipbuilding and such is going to get cut back, so the situation is going to get worse there. And I think it's one of the reasons why they took up the question of Glass-Steagall so quickly. Also, you know, their congresswoman, who's now a senator, Mazie Hirono, you know, they believe should be one of the sponsors of Glass-Steagall on the Senate side. And I think this is the other factor of what's happening in some of these state houses, where they realize that their federal elected officials are not doing enough to defend them and to work for them in Washington.
Yes, it's a kind of, we're talking about, people know that the economy is a goner, but people are also knowing that, just what you said about the federal officials, it's no good to say we can't, we don't know, we're going to study, forget it, right? I think we'll point out, I don't think we mentioned in the course of the discussion so far, the Glass-Steagall concurrent resolution in the state of Maine was approved by acclamation.
Oh, yes.
There are 35 members of the upper house, that's the Senate, and on this Thursday, they just approved it by acclamation. It's official. That probably on Tuesday it'll go to the lower house that has 151 members in the state of Maine. And they have a Senator, Angus King, who had campaigned saying he wanted Glass-Steagall. Well, okay, right? Now's the time. Okay.
Well, this is the phenomenon. Many of these guys ran on a platform of Glass-Steagall, and now they're up there, and it is time to not shut up, but to actually put up and to do it. And they're hesitant, and that's why the work we're doing on a state level, look, even having it pass through acclamation in the state Senate is going to put pressure on a guy like Angus King.
Yeah.
and others, yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. But plus, it's the fact that it's part of a national movement.
Yeah.
It's not simply their home state. It's a national phenomenon that is going to... We are going to have a ton of fun starting on Monday, because Congress comes back after hiding and disappearing for 2 weeks. And they did, and they left, and they shouldn't have. It was an outrage that they left. And they're coming back, and they're going to come back to the fact that we now have this introduced in 13 states, passed completely in South Dakota, passed in the upper house of Maine, and legislative work, intense legislative work in 21 other states. This is not something that they're going to be able to avoid in Washington.
Right. Now, let me turn to a related but different facet, Andy. And I'm thinking, because the regime, that is the White House, whether we had for a while Tim Geithner and have somebody else, is it, forget it. This whole Obama, now into the second term, implementing these killer policies of bail-ins, bailouts. This week was in particular, I mean, Obama's the one who was the patsy to create the idea of sequestration. And this week we have thousands of people in every state in the country. If they have chemotherapy, which is, and they happen to be a Medicare, over 65 person, many of them are receiving notices that it's going to be discontinued because the clinic where they were getting it can't afford to give it to them because they're losing too much money as of April 1st. It's very simple. It's just overnight cuts. And this is what the whole Obama administration, this signifies what they represent. And in agriculture, that's why I'm turning to you, Andy, although it's open season here. You've had the White House in the form of Secretary of Agriculture Vilsack, the Agriculture Department's chief economist named Joe Glauber. They've been saying for weeks, well, true, there are very tight corn supplies and tight soybean supplies and tight feed supplies of hay. It's true we have fewer beef cattle. But don't worry, the weather will be okay this year. The yields are bound to return to normal, even though they haven't been for a few years. The bins are going to refill. Everything's going to be okay. So taking off from that, Andy, this is as evil as anything. It's really like saying some people are going to die, farmers are going to quit. How do you see it?
Well, the farmers are bombarded with so much propaganda as far as what are the stocks, what is this market going to do? What's the world production? It's always such a maze to try to negotiate. And the cartels, they know exactly what the stakes are and what the reserves and so forth. And right now, farmers are, they've locked down their financing for the coming planting season. And farmers are saying now, well, last year we had some of our corn in the ground and it's too cold yet we can't get in the fields. But that's the old timers talking. And what we're looking at is this financing thing. I'm just kind of at the edges of it where Dodd-Frank mm-hmm. is having an influence on the small commercial banks out here.
Oh, terrible.
And Dodd-Frank there's all kinds of rules and paperwork that you have to go through to try and avoid what happened in 2007, 2008, and the housing collapse and so forth. So what this one banker told me is that they're just pretty much getting out of home mortgages because the requirements that they have to submit are they almost have to hire another person to satisfy the Dodd-Frank rules. Well, we've got Title II on a level that is really ominous, but out here, these local bankers are somewhat intimidated because, you know, there has been inflation in grains and agriculture.
Right.
And so farmers have, where they were borrowing from the bank to put their crop in, there's some of these customers of these local banks that now have a similar amount in the bank, and they can finance their own crop.
Right.
So that takes the business away from what a bank is to loan money, and then they don't see the housing, the rural housing, as a viable. Plus, in the smaller suburban banks, the housing collapse really put a crunch on their reserves in the bank, and some of them went under. So the FDIC then has come in and mandated a fee that these banks are just shocked at, where one bank in the 2006 time period was paying $8,000 a year into FDIC to help keep a good reserve fund and FDIC. Now it's $100,000 a year, and these banks aren't used to getting $100,000. And it wasn't only, it was one time for 3 years they had to come up with $300,000 in this one particular bank, and I'm sure all the banks have a similar story to tell.
Right.
So the pressure is being put on banks, and plus this sequestration business in Washington, after the first of the year, they had to extend the wind credits. The government, we never would have had wind towers out here if the government hadn't subsidized it. We wouldn't have had any ethanol plants if the government wouldn't have subsidized it, and they extended those subsidies again. Plus, in the state legislature, the local co-ops are the electric co-ops is what provide all the rural farmers in America with electricity. Well, now there's talk of increasing electric rates, kind of a tax, and I don't know how it all is going to work, but if you don't provide some kind of a green energy, a solar panel or a wind generator, then you have to pay a penalty. Well, this is outrageous.
Uh-huh.
And I it hasn't passed the legislature yet. But
is that a state level?
This is at Minnesota level.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it will pass, but, you know, everything is in an uproar up there. They're talking about gay marriage, all these changes of subject issues, and you know that the representative that sponsored this resolution on Glass-Steagall, he was complaining about this handicap cutting. He said, "Can you imagine? I can't believe it." I said, "It's because we don't have Glass-Steagall,"
mm-hmm.
And as people that, you know, are in my shoes that are in various states, when you go into that legislature, it's intimidating. But you have the authority. You know more than these representatives and senator. And don't be intimidated by it. I mean, because our future is dependent on what you do. And now's the time. The iron's hot now. Don't wait till they're going to impose Cyprus bail-ins on us, because the bail-in is a very ominous departure, because that means that the empire can continue to control this breakdown situation by stealing from citizens, stealing their savings and their deposits, and keeping open too big to fail parasitical banking practices that is destroying this country. So Glass-Steagall, that's what we need. And I don't know if that completely goes over the agriculture situation, grain production has been where inflation has been, and animal agriculture is the one that's really challenged, the meat production. So they have to pay these high feed costs and so forth, and environmental regulations are becoming more and more invasive out here. I mean, that's the environmentalism. What's really an insidious intrusion into what normally has been is an occupation that you didn't have to worry about all this stuff.
Yeah. Right. And going back to your point about the iron is hot, we don't need any more vindication. I count on getting it, of course. Danielle, you were saying 4 years ago when we were circulating what if the Homeowner and Bank Protection Act type intervention, which states and counties and townships were calling for, had been passed in Washington, wouldn't be where we are now. That would have been heading on a different vector path from what has been spelled out as these privileged bailout bail-ins on behalf of a tiny echelon of these rotten international banking syndicates, right? And now it's the physical existence. On animal agriculture, I think, Andy, you know, you're in part of the northern part of the hog and corn region of the world. And I think it's a matter of months where you can't, if you're trying to raise a hog and it costs $140 or something like that, I don't know what it is at the present to raise up an animal to go to market, and you might make $10 or $20 a head or lose, there's only a matter of months till you just can't do it anymore, right?
Well, it's interesting. I'm in one of the premier meat producing area.
Right.
There's It's called JBS. It used to be Swift, and it was Armor before that. But JBS is out of Brazil, and they purchased this huge pork processing plant at Worthington, Minnesota.
By the way, they're the biggest in the world, the entire world, JBS.
And JBS, I've determined that JBS is just, you know, there's these Brazilians, but they're financed by InterAlpha. It's probably Santander or whatever that's buying up this pork processing plant, and we don't have the Americans aren't producing enough workers. We're not producing people out here like we used to, so we have to have a lot of immigrants come in from all over the world. There's like 20, 30 languages that's spoken in Worthington, and it's a big semi-trucks bringing live hogs in and then refrigerated trucks pulling the meat out to go to the west, the east coast, and all over the country. This is a kind of a very fragile system, and if you start intervening in that and putting pressure on the producers, and then, you know, the fuel price goes up and it costs to ship this meat around, and it just gets more and more costly, and, you know, it's a fragile thread between eating and not eating.
Right. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you one thing too, Danielle. I think that's couldn't be clearer. Food is now you see it, now you don't. People, that's what's happening. And Danielle, for some people, the identity crisis phase is past. Remember, you've known people over the years that were active in the National Black Caucus that wouldn't tolerate bringing out who Obama was, the look at me Obama that was going to implement genocide. That was
right.
But that's changed, right?
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. On a state level, I think there are two things. When I was working with a team of people over the summer just prior to the Democratic convention, and we very much knew that we had the support to actually get Glass-Steagall as part of the platform for the Democratic Convention.
That was out in Detroit, I think, or where? Yeah.
Going into this Democratic Convention,
the convention
which nominated Obama at the Democratic Convention.
Right.
And but the mental block and emotional block really was around Obama. And quite often people wouldn't even discuss with us what was going on because they knew what we had said about Obama, which is, he's a fascist and he's going to kill you. We put the mustache on him. Mm-hmm. And what has now happened in the post-election era and between, as one of our supporters testified at one of these hearings in support of Glass-Steagall, and he said, you know, to these elected officials, he said, what is going on here? First, I hear nonstop about the fiscal cliff. Then I hear nonstop about sequestration. And I'm watching Wall Street get all these bailouts, and I'm saying, what is going on?
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is often what these state elected officials are now confronted with. They're no longer compelled to feel that somehow they have to defend Obama. The election's over, but also whatever illusions they had about Obama, and they really often love to say, well, he wants to do what's right, but it's the Republicans, or he was given this crisis. And after 4 years of this, and the fact that they are looking at a situation where people are dying unnecessarily.
Yeah.
And what they were handed by the federal government this year was less than zero. They are being demanded from Obama directly that of massive genocidal type budget cuts, states like California, Texas, Maryland, they went into their legislative session gleeful because they had a surplus in their budget. Oh, we've got all this money we can spend. Da, da. And here they are at the end of their term, at least California now and Maryland now, and they're massively cutting health care. They're scrambling to deal with the looming Social Security cuts. They're scrambling to deal with the cutoffs on private hospitals, the cutoffs on federal funding. So any illusions they had about Obama are just washing away because they see that there is no relief. In New York, some of these state legislators are furious because they were hit and devastated by Sandy.
Yeah.
And you're dealing with a situation where it's now 6 months later, and people are still living in tents. And it's an unacceptable situation, and the president, you know, offers no relief, and in fact, the exact opposite. And they're really beginning to see that the White House doesn't care whether people live or die, and this has forced a situation where these state-elected officials are now beginning to say, this is who this guy is, and he really doesn't care about us.
Right. Andy,
we went into the legislature and went into both the Democratic and Republican offices, and we tried to emphasize that this Glass-Steagall is really a nonpartisan issue, and would say, well, this senator was interested in supporting this, and he was Democrat, and on the other side, the Republicans, they were good on it, too. I remember we walked into one office, and on the wall was this wide-angle, beautiful color photograph of the 35W bridge collapse, just laying in the Mississippi River there, and it stuns you when you look at it.
Yeah.
That this is America, and Minnesota had to deal with this, and now they don't have the funds to fix all the bridges. I mean, you can't fix all the bridges in just a few years, and you've got 40 years of backlog to fix. And then we were in a senator's office, and on Danielle, on what you said about Obama, he was, you know, this is a really good Democrat, one of the leaders, and he made an offhanded dig about Obama, and we picked up on it, and we didn't, you know, comment on it, but it was insightful that here's this guy that's supposed to be a leader in the Democratic Party, and he's digging Obama. So I don't know what he would say publicly, but there's so much turmoil and ferment out here, and it's only going to ratchet down more. You can smell it. You can see the future here.
Yeah. I think the beauty of what we've done around this fight for Glass-Steagall, national banking, the WAPA, is we, months ago, LaRouche put forth the challenge that we had to get rid of the two-party system. And, of course, you wonder, what does that mean? How would you do that? And it's being done around a fight around a real principle. In Maryland, we had Tea Party Republicans who went all out for Mitt Romney, and very, very liberal union Democrats that went all out for Obama, but they joined forces for Glass-Steagall. And I think you're seeing a similar phenomenon and a similar potential throughout the nation. And we have to deliver that message in the month of April to Washington, D.C., that not acting on Glass-Steagall immediately will not be tolerated by the citizens, by the state governments, by the localities. We've reached an unacceptable situation, and we have to move forward on Glass-Steagall right now. And that's the message that we have to take responsibility to deliver immediately.
Well, in the final minutes, let me ask you too, Danielle, about this also, part and parcel on principle is the issue of war. And if you take in Congress what Walter Jones introduced and others, the HCR 3?
Three, yeah. Yes, House Concurrent Resolution.
And that, I'm sure, if you want to say something about that too, there are individuals for the same reason that feel this, we are beyond any kind of justification for saying or for allowing the administration to do a Tony Blair and just commit forces and fight anywhere immediately, Syria, but foment the situation in the Pacific with North Korea. You're getting response on that, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Maryland is a very liberal democratic state. And but here, you bring up this policy of Obama of the drones,
yes,
or even these illegal wars, and they don't even try to defend it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one of the reasons why we have been in our field work in Maryland. We have been very, very successful through the years because we absolutely stood our ground on Obama. And they hated us for it in the beginning, the general population.
Yeah.
But now, more and more, they're well aware that we are not the ones who put the mustache on Obama. We only revealed it.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's coming clear. It's becoming clearer and clearer. And I think in a lot of localities where you have the families and the returning veterans who perhaps at times did defend Obama, it's washing away very, very rapidly.
You know, Andy, you probably see the same thing in a completely different setting.
Oh, is it different? When I graduated from college back in the 60s, I was on the road to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, my college training didn't prepare me for that. Mm-hmm. And it took a long, well, it was just overwhelming that, you know, this is my country, this is how we operate, and there are other veterans that are in the LaRouche organization that one of the reasons they're in is because of what they saw America do in Vietnam, and now we've done it time and time again. Every time we turn around, they've got another country they're destroying, and this is not really America's what the Constitution represents, but we've been taken over by this empire, and people have to realize that, you know, back in 1776, the cry was the British are coming, and this time it's the empire is coming, and the monarchy out of England is controlling how we're operating. And, you know, it's just amazing when you see that the sequestration is diminishing the Defense Department budget and the workers and all the infrastructure for the military, and then the military is called on to go and get involved in more silly, stupid Vietnams. I mean, it is just, you know, America, why do we put up with this?
Okay, I couldn't think of a better way to say we're not putting up with it. It's our time has passed. But and since you raised empire, that's what we're up against, and that's the enemy, and that's why it's do or die, right? So anyway, I want to thank you for this. Is the April 6th LaRouche Show, Danielle DeToy in Maryland and Andy Olson in Minnesota, and this will be the end of the show, and April 13th will be our next one. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.